Hello, this is Mark Grier. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 13th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, first article today. The shutdown is over. When will things get back to normal? Some programs, like SNAP, could be restored within hours, while other effects could take longer to unravel. For the first time in more than 40 days, Washington was set to open for business on Thursday, although some federal services would be slow to return and thousands of government employees were left unaware of when they might receive their missing paychecks. The longest federal shutdown in U.S. history came to a close on Wednesday night as President Trump signed legislation to reopen the government. But it will take some time for the programs and people who were affected by the funding freeze to recover. Furloughed federal employees will have to come back to work, including those responsible for processing payments to programs that are dependent on government dollars. Industries like the airline and hospitality sectors, which felt the punch of the government spending lapse, might need even more time to regain their footing. And the rest of the economy that felt the domino effect of the shutdown may feel the impact for some time. Here are some of the ways the United States has to recover from the shutdown and how long that may take after the government officially opens. When will federal workers get back pay and return to work? Well, federal law requires that federal workers whose paychecks were paused during the shutdown be made whole. In the past, it has taken about a week for unpaid workers to receive back pay, though the Office of Personnel Management said it varies by agency. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has said that air traffic controllers will receive the first 70% of their back pay within 24 to 48 hours of the shutdown ending. But it is not clear if other parts of the government will be on similar schedule. It is also unclear if some departments will take longer to make workers whole because of increased vacancies in agency payroll, offices as a result of the Trump administration's downsizing efforts. In the past, the back pay arrived in one check, a lump sum much higher than what employees would have received if they were paid on the normal schedule. Because of that, many will be taxed at a higher rate, an issue that they will have to sort out with the Internal Revenue Service during tax season next year. When will food stamp benefits be fully restored? Though the Trump administration fought efforts to force them to use contingency funds to pay out benefits under the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, during the shutdown, a spokeswoman for the White House's budget office insists this week that beneficiaries will see their accounts fully restored within hours of the federal government reopening. About 1 in 8 Americans, 42 million people, rely on SNAP benefits for helping in purchasing groceries. When will Head Start programs come back online? It could take up to 2 weeks for the 20 Head Start early childhood programs that were forced to close temporarily during the shutdown to come back online, said Tommy Sheridan, the deputy director of the National Head Start Association. Head Start is a crucial lifeline for hundreds of thousands of disadvantaged families and children. In recent days, 20 programs in 17 states and Puerto Rico that served more than 9,000 children were closed temporarily because of the shutdown, he said. It is not clear how quickly each program will receive the funds it needs to restart. Many Head Start programs that had federal funding lapses stayed open with an infusion of money from other sources, including states. When will air travel get back to normal? Representatives of the airline industry have estimated it will take about a week for air travel to return to normal after the shutdown. But to keep to that schedule, a few things need to happen. The Transportation Department must find that air traffic controllers are returning to work in large enough numbers that the threat of staffing triggers forced delays when families are understaffed is minimal. Mr. Duffy then needs to lift mandated flight restrictions at 40 airports, which began last Friday. On Wednesday night, as the House voted on legislation to end the shutdown, Mr. Duffy and FAA's administrator said the agency would continue restricting 6% of flights at those airports until further notice. But officials are hoping that operations will recover in time for the Thanksgiving travel rush, which ramps up the weekend before the holiday. When will museums and the National Zoo be open? While national parks generally stayed open during the shutdown with reduced services, Washington, D.C.'s network of Smithsonian museums, including the National Zoo, closed to the public within days of the government closing. Representatives for the museums and zoo did not immediately provide guidance on how long it might take to open their doors to the public once Congress restores the federal government's funding, but noted that they would put a reopening schedule on their websites. The last shutdown may prove to be a guide. On Friday, January 25th, 2019, President Trump signed a bill reopening the federal government after a shutdown that lasted over 34 days. The Smithsonian Museums and the zoo reopened to the public 4 days later. When will economic data be released? The government shutdown shuttered the statistical agencies that produce data on employment, inflation, consumer spending, and other aspects of the economy, leaving policymakers flying blind at a critical moment for the economy. When the government reopens, that fog will begin to lift, but only gradually. The Bureau of Labor Statistics will probably be able to release job market data from September within a few days of the government reopening. Other reports on September, such as data on retail sales, could also come out relatively quickly. But the statistical agencies had to pause new data collection during the shutdown, which means they don't have any information about what happened in October. Collecting that data will take time, and in some cases, may be impossible. The White House recently suggested that it doesn't expect the Labor Statistics Agency to release a Consumer Price Index report for October, although some private sector economists argue a report is still possible. Even when the data is released, some of it may come with an asterisk. Many government statistics are based on surveys of households and businesses. When those surveys are delayed, there is a risk that people won't accurately remember what they were doing during the relevant period. Okay, on to the next article. What's behind the coming House vote on releasing the Epstein files? Proponents of fuller transparency used an arcane rule to prod their leaders to act. When it becomes clear they had succeeded, the Speaker agreed to hold a vote. After it received a 218th signature on Wednesday night, a bipartisan effort to force the House to vote on a measure that would compel the Justice Department to release the Epstein files advanced to the next stage. With President Trump and House Republican leaders opposed, proponents had turned to an arcane procedural tactic known as a discharge petition, which allows them to circumvent House leadership and bring bills onto the floor if a majority of members, 218 of them, sign on. When it became clear that they had succeeded, Speaker Mike Johnson who had gone to extraordinary lengths to avoid a vote on such a measure, relented on Wednesday night and said he would bring the measure to a vote next week. Here's how the process will work. Who is discharging what? The House of Representatives operates by majority rule, but in practice, the Speaker and the leaders of the majority party control how and whether bills move to the floor. Normally, when legislation is introduced, it gets referred to a House committee that is controlled by the majority. That committee is not required to act, and bills opposed by the leadership effectively die at this stage. A discharge petition is supposed to provide an end run around this problem. Its name comes from the act of discharging a bill from committee. In this case, Representatives Thomas Massie, Republican of Kentucky, and Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, were looking to force a vote on a bill that would require the Justice Department to release within 30 days material on its investigation into the deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and his longtime associate Ghislaine Maxwell. The lawmakers turned to a discharge petition after it became clear that Mr. Johnson would not bring the bill, which the White House has fought to kill, to the floor. A 218th signature started the clock on action. Mr. Massie and Mr. Khanna began collecting signatures in September, but their petition was only able to reach the 218-member threshold on Wednesday when Representative Adelita Gravala, Democrat of Arizona, signed it just minutes after she was sworn into office. Once 218 members have signed a discharge petition, the signatures are effectively frozen and none can be removed. Mr. Trump spent the hours before the final signature feverishly lobbying Republican senators' signatures to remove their names, including dispatching the Attorney General and FBI Director to meet with Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican of Colorado, in the White House Situation Room. None budged. Typically, once it reaches 218 signatures, a discharge petition must ripen for 7 legislative days. Not calendar days, but the days when the House is in session and conducting legislative business. Then a member can call up the measure on the floor, and the Speaker must schedule it for a vote within the next 2 days. Mr. Massie said on Wednesday night that he had checked with the House parliamentarian and learned that even if one of the members who signed the petition left Congress or died, their signature would still stand. That question was particularly relevant because one signatory, Representative Mickey Sherrill, the New Jersey Democrat who was just elected governor of her state, said she would resign from the House next week, while the measure was expecting to be ripened. Because of the House's schedule, which includes a week-long Thanksgiving break, it initially appeared that the House would not vote on the Epstein measures until the first week of December, but the Speaker said he would not wait that long. Johnson seems to have opted to rip off the Band-Aid. On Wednesday evening, Mr. Johnson said he would speed up the timeline and schedule the Epstein vote next week rather than running down the procedural clock on the discharge petition. Mr. Johnson continues to oppose the bill, arguing that it is unnecessary and that a separate investigation into Mr. Epstein by the House Oversight Committee is a more effective vehicle for transparency. As Speaker, he could use procedural maneuvers to try to table the bill, as he did with an unrelated discharge petition earlier this year. But Mr. Johnson had said that he would bring the measure to the floor if it got the majority support, and his decision to move the vote up suggested he saw no reason to forestall the inevitable. The Epstein measure is likely to pass the House, but has no path to enactment. And every representative who signed the petition also votes for the Epstein measure. It would pass the House. In fact, it is expected to draw even more votes than that. Republican leaders expect that some of their members who did not sign the discharge petition, which many lawmakers frown upon as an act of party disloyalty that undercuts their leaders, are likely to vote for the resolution itself. Representative Don Bacon of Nebraska already told reporters this week that he would support the measure, even though he did not join the effort to force a vote on it. If the bill does pass the House, it will then be sent to the Senate, where it faces tough odds. The Senate is under no obligation to take up bills sent by the House, and it would take 60 votes to force any action on the floor. Democrats hold 47 seats, and so even if they all backed the measure, they would still need 13 Republicans to buck Mr. Trump's wishes to join them. If the bill were to pass the Senate, it would be sent to the president's desk, and he would all but certain to veto it. Even if he did not, the only way to compel cooperation with such a measure would be for the House to enforce it by holding the Attorney General in contempt of Congress, an exceedingly unlikely scenario. A House vote is its own defeat for Republicans. Republicans were hoping to avoid a vote on the Epstein files because they did not want to be put in a politically difficult position. Mr. Trump has exhorted his supporters to move on from the Epstein investigation, and he has, in the past several months, called Republicans with continued concerns stupid, foolish, and very bad. But many of Mr. Trump's right-wing supporters were primed to expect explosive revelations in the Epstein files by Mr. Trump and some of his top allies. They were outraged when the Justice Department closed an investigation on the matter in July without releasing all of its files, and have clamored for more information, flooding their members of Congress with phone calls, emails, and social media posts pushing them to fight for more transparency. Republicans did not want to find themselves in a political jam as they navigated those competing demands from their constituents who elected them and Mr. Trump, who is the leader of their party and wants to keep the matter closed. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Okay, now one more article about the Epstein situation. What newly released emails tell us about Epstein and Trump. The House Oversight Committee on Wednesday released more than 20,000 pages of documents from Jeffrey Epstein's estate. Times reporters provide context on key emails. House Democrats on Wednesday released several emails that were obtained from the estate of the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, saying they showed that President Trump may have been more aware of Mr. Epstein's conduct than he has publicly acknowledged. Soon after, House Republicans released more than 20,000 pages of Mr. Epstein's documents, including a vast trove of his emails and other messages covering a period of many years. In a post on social media, Mr. Trump said the Democrats were bringing up the Epstein hoax to deflect from the government shutdown. House Republicans asserted that the emails shared by the House Democrats revealed little information. Here are some of the key emails released Wednesday and what they say about Mr. Epstein and Mr. Trump's relationship. House Democrats pointed to three emails in which Epstein said Trump knew of his conduct. In spring of 2011, Mr. Epstein was emerging from his legal troubles and trying to stave off further consequences. The tabloids had recently spotted him out and about, trying to return to his old social circles. Mr. Epstein was sensitive to what was being said about him, emailing with his employees about negative news coverage. Mr. Trump, now a star on his reality television show, The Apprentice, was talking publicly about running for president. On Wednesday, Republicans on the House Oversight Committee said on X that the victim the email exchange referred to was Virginia Guthrie, who was 16 when she was recruited by Mr. Epstein's longtime associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, while she was working as a spa attendant at Mar-a-Lago in 2000. When Mr. Epstein sent the email in April of 2011, Ms. Guthrie had recently gone public for the first time about her experiences with Mr. Epstein, telling a British tabloid that he had abused her and trafficked her to other men, and providing the outlet with a now famous photo of herself, Prince Andrew, and Ms. Maxwell. In 2016, Ms. Guthrie was asked in a civil case if Mr. Trump had witnessed the sexual abuse of minors in Mr. Epstein's home, and she said, "I don't think Donald Trump participated in anything." A representative for Ms. Guthrie's family declined to comment. During the 2016 presidential campaign, Mr. Epstein remained mostly in the background, despite curiosity about his ties to not only Mr. Trump, but also former President Bill Clinton. Mr. Epstein was dealing with fallout from his conduct, but was far from infamous figure he is now. Still, Mr. Epstein continued to socialize with notable people. Among them was the journalist Michael Wolff, who encouraged Mr. Epstein to speak out about Mr. Trump and went on to write a biography of the president's early in his first administration. During a presidential debate on December 15, 2015, Mr. Trump did not field any questions about Mr. Epstein, according to a transcript, despite an assertion about a media appearance that day by Mr. Wolff beforehand. It was unclear if Mr. Trump was asked about the matter separately. By January 2019, Mr. Trump was in the White House and Mr. Epstein was back in the news. A series of Miami Herald articles showed that he received lenient treatment from prosecutors years earlier, including from Alexander Acosta, who was Mr. Trump's labor secretary at the time. Mr. Epstein's schedules showed he had continued to meet with Mr. Wolff, who has said he sat in on some unreleased recorded interviews that Steve Bannon, a former Trump advisor, had conducted with Mr. Epstein. Soon after this email exchange, the Justice Department said it was investigating how Mr. Epstein's plea deal had been handled. Shortly before Mr. Trump won his first election in 2016, Mr. Wolff reached out to Mr. Epstein under the subject line, "Now could be the time," suggesting he could harm Mr. Trump's chances by speaking out. It was unclear specifically what Mr. Wolff believed Mr. Epstein would say, or whether Mr. Epstein responded to the message. One theme that has emerged from the emails is how Mr. Wolff appeared to act as an advisor to Mr. Epstein and suggested he speak publicly against Mr. Trump. In another email exchange earlier in 2016, Mr. Wolff advised Mr. Epstein to take an anti-Trump position as a way to get ahead of the upcoming release of the book, Filthy Rich, about Mr. Epstein's life and crimes. After Mr. Trump announced in February 2017 that he would choose as his labor secretary Mr. Acosta, Mr. Epstein wrote his defense lawyer, Roy Black, to ask who will represent Acosta at hearings. Mr. Acosta was the U.S. attorney in southern Florida when Mr. Epstein agreed to a lenient plea deal in 2008 that allowed him to avoid federal sex trafficking charges. Mr. Black replied that Mr. Acosta will be by himself, with perhaps a Trump administration to assist with the accompanying him. The Epstein deal was brought up during Mr. Acosta's confirmation hearing. Mr. Acosta defended it, saying it was offered based on the evidence he had at the time. Mr. Acosta was confirmed, but he would resign in 2019 after Mr. Epstein was charged in New York. That provoked a new round of questions about Mr. Acosta's role in the 2008 deal. Shortly before Mr. Epstein was arrested in July of 2019 on federal sex trafficking charges, one of his advisors, Richard Kahn, wrote him an email about Mr. Trump. The email indicated that Mr. Kahn had gone through Mr. Trump's federal financial disclosure form and sent Mr. Epstein 9 findings about Mr. Trump's loans, income, and foundation. Mr. Kahn called the financial disclosure form 100 pages of nonsense. It wasn't clear why Mr. Kahn was looking into Mr. Trump's finances or whether Mr. Epstein responded. The email was one of multiple messages in which Mr. Epstein's associates provide him with information about Mr. Trump. Okay, next article. Comey and James challenge appointment of Trump loyalist prosecuting them. The outcome could have serious consequences for the cases against two of President Trump's opponents, James Comey, the former FBI director, and Letitia James, the New York Attorney General. A federal judge is posing to hear arguments on Thursday about whether the U.S. attorney handpicked by President Trump to prosecute two of his most prominent political opponents was lawfully appointed to her job, a question that could have serious consequences for the case. The arguments are set to take place at a high-stakes hearing in federal district court in Alexandria, Virginia, where prosecutors and defense lawyers will square off over whether the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, Lindsay Halligan, was in her post legally when she obtained indictments against James Comey, the former FBI director, and Letitia James, the New York Attorney General. The cases are playing out separately, but lawyers for Mr. Comey and Ms. James have joined forces to ask the judge, Cameron McGowan Curie, to throw out both sets of charges if she determines that Ms. Halligan was improperly installed at Mr. Trump's direct command in September. The lawyers say this drastic step is needed because, in a highly unusual move, Ms. Halligan secured the indictments personally after none of her subordinates would do so, and was the only person to sign the charging documents. When Ms. Halligan presented Mr. Comey's indictment to the grand jury just days before the statute of limitations expired, she purported to hold the mantle of U.S. attorney of the U.S. attorney, lawyers wrote in court papers this week. But in fact, she was no different than a private citizen. Judge Curie has signaled she is interested in precisely that issue. And last week, she ordered the prosecutors handling both cases to provide her with a complete set of documents related to Ms. Halligan's grand jury presentations. The prosecutors in Mr. Comey's case initially turned over only the transcript of an FBI agent who testified to the grand jury, neglecting to hand over the transcript of Ms. Halligan's remarks. Ultimately, the prosecutors corrected their error, blaming the mistake on the service that had transcribed the grand jury proceedings. Judge Curry, an appointee of President Bill Clinton, who normally sits in South Carolina, was assigned to the cases after all the Local federal judges were forced to step back to avoid any appearance of conflict in deciding on the appointment of the U.S. attorney they routinely deal with. Other federal judges have already ruled that Mr. Trump's Justice Department unlawfully used arcane procedural maneuvers to put loyalists in place atop three other U.S. attorneys' offices. Those include Alina Habba, who was put in charge of the U.S. Attorney's Office in New Jersey, Sigal Chadha, who was named the acting U.S. Attorney for Nevada, and Bilal Asele, whom Mr. Trump put in the top job at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Central District of California. In many ways, however, the legal battle over Ms. Halligan, who served as both a White House aide and a personal lawyer to Mr. Trump before taking control of the federal prosecutor's office in Virginia, is unique. First, none of the other U.S. attorneys found by the courts to have been improperly appointed have handled the sort of a high-profile, politicized prosecutions like the ones Ms. Halligan has brought against Mr. Comey and Ms. James. Moreover, none of the others were as personally involved in the grand jury process as Ms. Halligan was. They also did not put themselves in the potentially vulnerable position of having been the only prosecutor to have formally signed indictments like Ms. Halligan did. Ms. Halligan's involvement in the cases against Mr. Comey and Ms. James has been extraordinary from the start, reflecting the ways in which Mr. Trump has trampled over the longstanding tradition of the White House's keeping distance from the affairs of the Justice Department. He put her in charge of the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Virginia, a critical outpost known for handling terrorism and national security matters, with explicit public instructions to go after Mr. Comey and Ms. James, and despite the fact that she had never worked on a criminal prosecution. Moreover, he cleared a path for her by ousting her predecessor, Eric Siebert, a career prosecutor who had refused to indict Mr. Comey out of concerns that there was insufficient evidence. Lawyers for Mr. Comey and Ms. James have argued that Mr. Siebert himself served a 120-day stint as interim U.S. attorney, the maximum permitted under the law. Because of that, they have claimed Ms. Halligan should not be allowed to serve her own 120-day term. If the Attorney General could make back-to-back sequential appointments of interim U.S. attorneys, the lawyers wrote, the 120-day period would be rendered meaningless, and the Attorney General could indefinitely evade the alternate procedures that Congress mandated. Federal prosecutors working under Ms. Halligan have pointed to a small procedural wrinkle. They reminded Judge Curry that when Ms. Siebert's interim position came to an end, the judges in the Eastern District of Virginia used their own authority to reappoint him. That intervening development, prosecutors say, should allow Ms. Halligan to also serve a four-month stint as the interim U.S. attorney. Just to be sure, however, Attorney General Pam Bondi sought last week to create a kind of fail-safe. In an unorthodox sworn statement, Ms. Bondi said that for the avoidance of doubt, she had retroactively named Ms. Halligan to a second post, that of special attorney, with the authority to handle the prosecutions of both Mr. Comey and Ms. James. All right, next article. Canadian travel to the U.S. declines for the 10th straight month. The drop has been reflected in air and car travel, according to Canadian statistics. Tensions over tariffs placed by the Trump administration spurred calls for Canadians to spend their money at home. Canadians are keeping up their efforts to boycott travel to the United States, with air travel from the country dropping last month by nearly 24%, and car travel by more than 30%, compared with the same time last year, according to data released Wednesday by Canada's Statistics Office. The decline, which has lasted 10 consecutive months, is part of a broader shift in Canadians' attitudes towards the United States, amid tensions over President Trump's tariffs on Canadian goods and the rhetoric that many Canadians feel is condescending. In April, Mark Carney, then the Prime Minister-elect of Canada, introduced a pass that made access to the country's galleries, museums, and the National Rail Service free for those under 18 in a bid to encourage Canadians to see more of their own country. At a time when our economy is under attack from President Trump, Canadians are stepping up, helping our neighbors, buying local, and celebrating our beautiful country, Mr. Carney said. We are a proud country, he added, and united. We will strengthen our Canadian identity in the face of this crisis. Historically, Canadians have made up a large number of international travelers, accounting for roughly a quarter of foreign visitors to the United States. But their absence in driving down international travel spending, which is expected to drop 3.2% to $173 billion this year, according to a recent report from the U.S. Travel Association, a nonprofit group that represents the American travel industry. As outbound international travel keeps growing, the group said, the travel trade deficit for 2025 was on track to reach nearly $70 billion. Laura Presley, an analyst with Statistics Canada, which released the new government data, said that while the group kept track of Canadian tourism to the United States, it has been monitoring the figures more closely in light of the rising tensions over trade. It was not the first time, Ms. Presley said, that Canadians had avoided the United States. Numbers also declined after the September 11th terrorist attack in New York City in 2001 and in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. But, she added, what makes this more notable is the extent of it, or the length of the trend. In many cases, Canadians have cited the Trump administration as the reason for choosing not to visit. Some Canadian snowbirds who had ordinarily spent their winters in warmer destinations like Palm Springs, California, said they were canceling trips, cutting visits short, or even selling their homes in the United States. In August, the Girl Guides of Canada, its equivalent to the Girl Scouts, said it was pausing U.S. trips over safety concerns. And even many of those who live just across the border and once regularly crossed into New York to enjoy the changing fall foliage have stopped coming. Julian Karsagian, a visiting lecturer in economic policy at McGill University, who studies U.S.-Canada relations and is based in Ottawa, said she believed it was President Trump's rhetoric, in particular, that had turned away many Canadians. The tariff war is one thing, but it's the tone of the trade war. It's the tone of the poking about 51st state, he said. All right, next article. Rubio shrugs off allies' concerns over U.S. drug strikes. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has said no one raised the Caribbean military operation in closed-door meetings at a G7 summit, but ministers from France and the European Union publicly called them unlawful. Secretary of State Marco Rubio left a meeting of major foreign allies on Wednesday, saying that he had heard no objections to ongoing U.S. military strikes targeting what the Trump administration has described as drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific. But speaking to reporters on the sidelines of their official meetings at the group of 7 foreign ministries meeting in Canada, two senior European diplomats called the Trump administration's lethal attacks illegitimate. But Mr. Rubio showed little concern about charges that the strikes, which Pentagon officials say have killed dozens of drug smugglers tied to Venezuela's government, lack legal justification. The bottom line here is that the president is going to defend the national interest and national security of the United States, which is under threat by these terrorist organizations, he told reporters in Hamilton, Ontario. Mr. Rubio also serves as the National Security Advisor. Trump officials have designated several drug cartels as terrorist groups and say that this gives the administration legal authority to kill their members. But some legal experts disagree, arguing that the fatal attacks are extrajudicial killings. Mr. Rubio added that many of the drug shipments targeted by the U.S. military are ultimately bound for Europe, so maybe they should be thanking us. He spoke at a news conference after a day of meetings near Niagara Falls, where other topics include bolstering Ukraine's defenses against Russia, ensuring long-term peace in Gaza, and stopping Sudan's brutal civil war. The Group of Seven, known as the G7, is an informal coalition of major industrialized democracies that cooperate on global economic and social issues. On Tuesday, France's foreign minister, Jean-Noël Barrot, told reporters in Ontario that the U.S. strikes in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific violate international law. In an interview with NBC News at the G7 event, the European Union's top diplomat, Kaja Kallas, also said the American strikes lacked any legal basis and that she had discussed the issue with fellow ministers. She added that drug trafficking is a major concern and that international law on the issue should be reviewed. Mr. Rubio, when asked about her remarks, said, "I don't think the European Union gets to decide what international law is." And he said the subject has not been raised behind closed doors at the event. Not a single person brought it up. Asked about the U.S. strikes, Canada's foreign minister, Anita Anand, and the official host of the event, said that her country had assisted the United States with counter-narcotics efforts, but that we have no involvement in the American action in the waters off Latin America. She also demurred over whether the strikes violated international law, saying that it was within the purview of U.S. authorities to make that determination. Ms. Anand said she and Mr. Rubio had not discussed U.S.-Canada trade talks, which Mr. Trump angrily suspended last month. She said that issue falls under the portfolio of Canada's trade minister. To the relief of Canadian officials, Mr. Trump has largely dropped his talk of making Canada a 51st state. On Tuesday, Ms. Anand said that Mr. Rubio had not raised the issue or even insinuated it with her since she became Canada's foreign minister in May. An official joint statement by the group of ministers also declared unwavering support for Ukraine, whose foreign minister attended the gathering to ask for more assistance in holding off Russian assaults. Okay, next article is from the opinion section. It's an article written by Kristen Anderson. Voters view Republicans as strong and a party of action. Democrats need some of that. The good feelings within the Democratic Party stemming from its dominating electoral victories last week have come to a screeching halt, with a breakaway group of Senate Democrats brokering a compromise with Republicans to reopen the government. The realities of holding together a large and unwielding party coalition had been laid bare. Facing pressure from their activists to fight President Trump as hard as they can, Democrats are experiencing significant blowback, most of it coming from within their own ranks. As the 2026 midterms approach, Democrats will have to try to put aside the squabbling and decide on a strategy for winning at the ballot box. And central to that strategy will be answering a crucial question. Do Democrats have an agenda of their own, or do they simply want to run as not Donald Trump? Here, they might take a lesson from Republicans. Recent polling shows, like it or not, Republicans have a plan and voters know what it is, even if they think some parts of it go too far. In CBS News polling from October, while the Republican Party was 13 percent points more likely to be viewed as extreme than the Democrats, it trounced Democrats on which party is more strong and effective. Voters were more likely to describe Democratic Party as weak by a 24-point margin compared to the Republicans. Polling by Reuters showed Republicans holding an advantage when voters are asked which party has the better plan on a wide range of issues. When I asked voters in my own polling which they preferred, a party that is better at getting things done, even if its views are sometimes too extreme, or a party that is more mainstream, though not as good at getting things done, voters preferred the action-oriented party by a 32-point margin. Even independents, who are normally more moderate, preferred such a party by 23 points. Nevertheless, as Mr. Trump's job approval ratings sink, running simply as a check and balance on the excesses of the president may seem a simple and appealing path for Democrats. Running on an agenda of action requires tougher conversations within the party about what issues to prioritize and how to advance them. My own polling shows that a majority of voters, 56%, say they are mostly concerned about pocketbook issues, compared with only 38% who cite border issues about democracy, freedom, and how we are governed. The polling shows that the cost of living and health care are the two issues voters most want leaders to focus on. At the same time, the angst within the Democratic Party over the move to reopen the government shows that achieving consensus on how to oppose Mr. Trump is hard to come by, to say nothing of what would be needed to get the entire party on the same page about a forward-looking agenda. The schism Democrats face today recalls the insurgency that emerged within the Republican Party following defeat at the hands of Barack Obama in 2008. Republicans were in turmoil, wrestling with how to move forward. Their party's overall brand image trailed that of the Democrats, driven largely by Republican voters who said they viewed their own party unfavorably. Agitated party activists bucked GOP leaders and elected candidates in primaries who were hardly the establishment favorites. Ask Republicans about that era about Christine O'Donnell. Excuse me. From this infighting emerged the Tea Party movement, a grassroots group of activists nettled by issues from the national debt to the Affordable Care Act to Mr. Obama's presidency in general. At first, these insurgents were dismissed by critics as unfocused, extreme in their message, or even funded by secretive billionaires. In the end, those Tea Party protests wound up being an early indicator that something was afoot in America that was going to shift the Republican Party and the country. For all their anger at their own party's leadership, frustrated Republicans were not exactly at risk of shunning the GOP and voting for Democratic candidates. The economy was still faltering under a Democratic president. Democrats were overconfident. By the end of that year, Republicans had won the governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia. A year later, their party has been reinvigorated. They flipped control of the House, picking up more than 60 seats, and gained 6 Senate seats as well. Today, No Kings protests against Mr. Trump's policies are similarly dismissed by those on the right. The Democratic victories last week are held up as isolated events in the political off year in states that lean blue anyways, rather than as an indicator of any broader political trend. Republicans most confidently point to polling about the Democrats' dismal brand image to bolster the case that they'll do just fine in the 2026 midterms. To be sure, Democrats are experiencing some of their lowest favorability ratings in decades, driven in part by their own partisans giving them an unfavorable rating. Because independents dislike both parties so much, brand image for a party is influenced by how many of its members express displeasure with their own side. In my own polling, 90% of Republicans feel favorably about their party, including majority 56% who view their party very favorably. By contrast, only 83% of self-described Democrats feel favorably about their party and do so much less fervently. But just as a poor brand image and internal discontent did not prevent Republicans from taking advantage of the political environment in 2010, Democrats could still hold their own in next year's midterms. The economy remains fragile. Republicans are at risk of being overconfident. Voters want leaders to focus on cost of living and aren't sure the Republicans in power right now are doing so. And instead of putting their efforts into issues like immigration or crime, they have faded into salience compared to a year ago. Democrats today are without much of a leader or a message. They are under pressure from their base to do more to stop Mr. Trump, but are less clear about what exactly they would do if given the task of governing once again. The midterm primaries next year will tell us a great deal about how Democratic voters think about their own party and whether it ought to go about critical task of winning elections again. Republicans should remember that not long ago, when their own party seemed leaderless and divided, economic discontent and grassroots energy powered them to victory over their complacent adversaries. If Democrats avoid nominating unelectable candidates at the midterms and can pursue any sort of credible message on cost of living and the economy, they will be more powerful force to be reckoned with than Republicans may expect. All right, one more article for today. The DNC ordered workers back to the office. Its union isn't pleased. Thumbs down emojis flowed on screen as Washington area employees learned they would have to show up 5 days a week. Their union called the move callous. The pandemic is long over, but the fight inside the Democratic National Committee over a full-time return to its office has just begun. Years after many companies ordered their employees back to work, DNC workers in the Washington area got the surprise news. Ken Martin, the party chairman, announced at an all-staff meeting on Wednesday afternoon that they would be expected to work in person at headquarters 5 days a week beginning in February. Mr. Martin explained that a full-time return to the office was necessary to ensure that information wasn't being siloed and that staff members would not miss out on time-sensitive decisions that will be made quickly in person ahead of the highly consequential midterm elections. The complaints began almost immediately. both in the room and on Zoom, where his comments were streamed to those working remotely. People who participated in the call described a flurry of thumbs-down emojis and other online expressions of discontent. By the end of the day, the party's union was calling the decision callous. Mr. Martin took questions at the meeting, which was described by four people who attended and who were granted to remain anonymous to describe the closed-door gathering. At one point, Mr. Martin responded to the frustration being aired by his employees and said that if DNC staff members did not like his return-to-work policies, they should consider finding another job elsewhere. He also suggested that the change in attendance policy had been a Band-Aid that was overdue to being ripped off. Many DNC officials are currently expected to work at least 3 days in the office per week. The leadership of the union representing DNC staff members, which is part of Local 500 of the Service Employees International Union, issued a statement to the New York Times on Wednesday calling Mr. Martin's remarks shocking. It was shocking to see the DNC chair disregard staff's valid concerns on today's term call. The union's leadership wrote, DNC staff worked extremely hard to support historic wins for Democrats up and down the ballot last Tuesday, and this change feels especially callous considering the current economic conditions created by the Trump administration. A spokeswoman for the DNC declined to comment on the record. The fact that some employees of certain Democratic campaigns and organizations have unionized has caused some quiet consternation among party leaders, even as the party broadly embraces organized labor. Just days before President Trump's inauguration last year, the Congressional Progressive Staff Association wrote a letter proposing a 32-hour work week that was widely mocked. The DNC's staff union, which ratified a bargaining agreement over the summer, pointed to language in which the party said it reaffirms its commitment to making hybrid work available. A DNC official noted that the agreement allowed for a return to the office with 60 days' notice. The union said it was considering its options, but had no action to announce. The DNC staff union remains committed to supporting our employees as whole people and will continue to hold management accountable to their contract, it said in the statement. At another point during the meeting, one DNC staff member argued to Mr. Martin that the party had won the 2020 presidential election with everyone working remotely and could do so again in 2028, according to two of the people who participated in the meeting and the party's staff union. Mr. Martin also said remote work accommodations would be granted case by case, one person said. The change in attendance policy at the DNC comes long after most of the corporate America and federal government have made similar moves. In March, Mr. Trump ended most remote work policies for employees of the executive branch. Not everyone at the DNC is part of the union, with managers and many political staff members remaining excluded. Late last year, the union called post-election layoffs a betrayal, though it is typical for the party to trim its staff after elections. You have listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Your reader today has been Mark Greyer. Thank you for listening.